Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined by Frank Cogliano. And it was Frank's birthday yesterday. Happy birthday, Frank.
Thank you, David. That's very kind. And sorry we missed last week. I was away.
Yes, you had to do the tough labor of going off to Italy to talk about George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. I'm sure it was a real labor for you to...
Somebody's got to do it, David. Somebody's got to do it.
All right. So our topic this week, in conjunction with recent events, is the relationship between politics and sports. And this is in part about, largely in response to comments the president made about a little bit over a week ago. Frank, do you want to sort of sum up recent events for people who are not paying attention to the president's every words and or what happens on the sporting fields?
Okay, sure. But before I do that, David, I have feedback from a listener we need to report.
Okay.
So one of our
listeners, that's good to hear.
We do. One of our most loyal listeners gave us some feedback on our last episode. That would be my wife, Mimi. And she listens to every episode and lets me know how we're doing. And she felt that I was too hard on you when I apparently, and I quote, jumped down your throat over the differences between Scottish and English higher education.
Okay.
I told her that it was all in good fun and we were both laughing, but she said, you don't have enough friends to be mean to David. So, so David, I would like to formally and in front of our entire audience apologize to you.
Thank you. I didn't take it personally. I assume that all of your jabs are meant in good fun. At least that's how I'm choosing to interpret them from my own side.
So anyway, but to get on to the events of the past few days. Last Friday, President Trump went to Alabama to attend a rally. There was a Republican primary for an open Senate seat down there. And he was speaking in favor of a candidate named Luther Strange.
Who ended up not winning the...
Yes, I mean, that's
a good primary. But.
That's quite interesting in and of itself. But anyway, President Trump was speaking in favor of Mr. Strange. And in the course of making his comments, he went on a riff about the National Football League in the United States. And the fact is that for several years, a number of players, particularly Colin Kaepernick, who was a quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, were silently protesting during the national anthem. And they were protesting against police violence and expressing support for Black Lives Matter. And so Kaepernick in particular started by kneeling during the national anthem, or taking a knee as it's come to be known. Kaepernick, interestingly, is now out of the league and can't find work, which is interesting in and of itself. But this movement had spread a little bit. It wasn't that widespread, it must be said. A couple of players on each team, probably, at the beginning of every game. And in response to this, President Trump went on a fairly lengthy riff, as he tends to do at these impromptu campaign events. Well, the campaign event wasn't impromptu. The way he speaks is impromptu. Which he said they should be fired. The league should fire them.
The owners
should fire them. Yes, thank you. But for disrespecting the flag. And he followed this up with a number of tweets over the weekend. In fact, he tweeted about sports for most of the weekend. And he tweeted about this issue in the NFL. And he also got into a little bit of a contretemps with Steph Curry, the star for the Golden State Warriors, who won the NBA championship earlier in the year, back in June. And traditionally, teams that win championships in the United States visit the White House. And they have a photo op with the president, and they usually give the president a shirt or something or other. And they, you know, it's part of the symbolism of the presidency. And Steph Curry, had said he probably wasn't going to go to this. And the Golden State Warriors are quite an interesting team in many ways, but they're quite politically engaged, particularly including their coach Steve Kerr. Trump responded to this by saying, Steph Curry's not sure he's coming to the White House. It's an honor to come to the White House. You're uninvited. Coach Kerr said, well, this is a bit like somebody in high school saying, you can't break up with me. I'm breaking up with you. And so the whole point was that Trump was heavily engaged in kind of blurring the line between sports and politics in the United States last weekend. And there was a subsequent backlash. other NBA players. So LeBron James, who lost in the NBA Finals to the Golden State Warriors, expressed support for Steph Curry and called the president a bum. And on Sunday and Monday during this week's NFL games, there were widespread protests by teams. Sometimes they stood and locked arms together. In other cases, they knelt. In the case of the Pittsburgh Steelers, the team, with the exception of one player, remained in the locker room during the national anthem. And there's been a furious backlash of people saying that these players are disrespecting the flag and disrespecting the military and the principles for which the flag stands. And there's been an ongoing kind of roiling debate in social media and in public this week about this, which is why we're talking about it. I think that's a summary of it, where we are.
And, well, and I think the protests, they've spread to baseball. There was a baseball player.
That's right.
I think UNC said their basketball team isn't going to the White House, supposedly because of a scheduling conflict, but nobody believes that. And I think there are other sports that are also, been doing some protests, like the WNBA for the past 2 years. It hasn't attracted as much media attention, but it has been, the protests there have been actually more robust than really anywhere else.
And I think one thing that has to be said in this, and I'm sure it'll come up in the context of our discussion today, race is at the heart of this. Leagues that President Trump really, chose to criticize last weekend were the NBA, which I think is 75% African-American, and the NFL, which is something like 68% black. Yeah. And so I think it's not a racial undertone. I think there's an overtone about this. Whereas...
He praised NASCAR.
He praised NASCAR. There have only ever been 4 African-American drivers in the history of NASCAR.
Yeah.
And he praised the Pittsburgh Penguins, who won the Stanley Cup last spring and are going to visit the White House. The NHL is overwhelmingly white.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, it's overwhelmingly foreign because there are lots of Canadians and Scandinavians.
Well, here's the thought I had about the NHL in the shower the other day, which is totally not really anything. It's the National.
David, we are taping.
It's the National Hockey League. Which nation is it?
Well, it's Canada and the United States.
But that's like 2 nations.
It is.
I was thinking, like, is it originally Canadian? Anyway, that's a thought that's tangential to anything. But yeah, the sort of racial politics of this is pretty clear.
Yeah, I mean, and the original protest began over police violence against African Americans. So, although critics of the protest have tried, with a good deal of success, frankly, to make this about the military and respect for the military, and that's President Trump's stated position, there's a kind of clear racial dimension to this that I don't think we can ignore.
And Kaepernick was very clear from the very beginning of this whole thing about what his motivations were and what the intended message was.
Right, that's right. So, looking at the history of this, David, why don't we? I mean, one of the things we talked about in planning for this week's episode was trying to provide some historic context for this because. Mm. Everybody's sort of been clutching their pearls and saying, this is terrible that we have politics in sports. Keep politics out of sports. And we both had the view that politics has always been in sports.
Sure.
Playing the national anthem is political.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, why don't we start with that, Dave? Can you talk a little bit about the history of playing the national anthem?
That's one of the things that many of our European colleagues are sort of baffled by, is why we play the national anthem in sporting events, because that's not something that happens here.
Except for internationals.
But you go to Scottish football matches on a regular basis, they don't play God Save the Queen, do they?
No. They come out and the referee blows the whistle at 3 o'clock and they kick off.
Oh, fair. there is an origin story for why American sports, they have the national anthem. And it actually precedes the national anthem being the national anthem. The Star Spangled Banner only becomes the national anthem in 1931, I believe. But the tradition of saluting the flag while that song is being played dates back to 1918.
What was going on in 1918, David?
Oh, what's going on? Historical context, 19. Well, there's a couple of things that are going on that sort of made that happen. One, obviously, is the First World War is in full swing, and there's a consequence of this. They actually shortened the baseball season a little bit, so they actually moved the World Series, and the World Series is where it first saluting the flag first happens. They actually move the make the World Series a little bit earlier so they can actually get players deployed into the First World War. Obviously, the First World War ends not that long after the World Series, but they didn't know that. So the context is, this is the World Series between the Cubs and the Red Sox. This is back when both of those teams regularly appeared in the World Series.
As they may this year.
And, yes. it was a very big type series. The Red Sox had this young pitcher who everybody thought was amazing, who they would then go on after the World Series to sell to the Yankees, a guy named Babe Ruth that some people may have heard of. But the particular context of it is that they often would bring bands to come and play songs, sort of military bands or other kinds of bands to play songs. And so they, at important games like the World Series, and Star Spangled Banner had been played at sporting events beforehand. But the phenomenon of saluting it actually comes to a game that took place in Chicago. There had been a bombing in Chicago earlier that month at the Chicago Board of Trade that was done probably by the Wobblies, the industrial workers of the world. And so when the World Series game came, a lot of people didn't go because they were worried about a potential bombing. The Cubs decided to actually play the World Series not in Wrigley Field, but in Kaminsky Park, which was bigger because they were hoping for a huge crowd. And when the huge crowd didn't show up, they were very worried about, revenue and attendance. During the seventh inning stretch, the band is playing a variety of songs. And when they get to the Star Spangled Banner, one of the Cubs players, who I think was about to be going shipped off in the Navy shortly after the World Series, he salutes the flag during the World Series. And other players then proceed to salute the flag after he does, and then everybody in the stands cheers wildly because they're obviously they're soldiers, American soldiers off, and the flag, patriotism.
Got to support the troops, David.
Well, and what happened was the next day they had a sold out crowd because they did the same thing, and so the owners realized if we play the national anthem, and people will be enthusiastic, even if they're not enthusiastic about the baseball, they'll be enthusiastic about supporting the country in the context of war. And so that's really where the tradition starts, in part as a sort of a financial move by the owners of the Cubs who wanted to make sure they could get people in the seats. It doesn't become a regular phenomenon, though, until really the Second World War. They bring bands to play the song, throughout the 20s and 30s for all-star games in the World Series and opening day. The problem was, of course, you actually need a band to do it. They didn't have good public address systems, so it's only during the Second World War and after the Second World War when the stadiums get public address systems put in place that allow them to do it without having a full military band that it becomes a phenomenon for every game. But I've noticed that it's actually become even more important as a phenomenon after September 11th. I think they've really sort of upped the game in terms of the pomp and circumstance they attach to it.
Yeah, I mean, they used to. Well, certainly, when I was growing up and when you were growing up, you'd go to a sporting event, say a baseball game, and they'd always play the national anthem before the game, and that would be it.
Yeah.
Whereas after 9/11, the seventh inning stretch in particular became a time when they would play God Bless America or some other patriotic songs, and there'd be presentations of the colors, or we'd salute the troops, they'd put troops on the pictures of local soldiers on the big screen, things like that.
I remember it used to be like recorded, and the national anthem was mostly just like they played a tape.
Yeah, that's right.
But now that's much more.
In fact, I went to Fenway Park earlier this year in May, and for the first time in years, and I was struck by the kind of level of overt patriotism that was kind of incorporated into the event. So there was the national anthem to start the game. Again, that's traditional, but massive flag, in the outfield, and a color guard to present it, and all that kind of thing. And then during the seventh inning stretch, we saluted the troops and so on. And it's these rituals have become much more prominent. You're absolutely right. I think 9/11 is the turning point for that, and it began rather spontaneously immediately after. I mean, part of the healing process in New York in particular was that World Series that year between the Yankees and the Arizona Diamondbacks and President Bush coming out and throwing the first pitch. And so there are rituals associated with these games that have kind of always been there, but they've been amped up in the past 16 years, I think, and they don't show any sign of going away.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I was really, as I said, I hadn't been to a major league baseball game. I've been to minor league baseball games in a few years, and I was really struck by the overt displays of patriotism. I mean, it's historian Robert Bella nearly 50 years ago wrote an essay about civic religion in the United States and how these kind of rituals of patriotism serve a really important function and serve a quasi-religious function. And it felt that way. I mean, I found it a little bit unsettling. I thought, come on, we're here for a baseball game. But, and it was, it was really striking to me, I think.
And I think, you know, it spread from baseball, you know, to the baseball.
Baseball was the dominant sport in the 20th
century. Football emulated it and you know, hockey and
football now is the dominant cultural enterprise in the United States. I mean, the NFL dwarfs all other sporting enterprises, and so the symbolism of it and the importance of it within the culture is pretty difficult to overstate, frankly.
Sure. Yeah. So, for thinking about times and places where sports and politics have intersected, I mean, I think there's a period between the Second World War, really, and then the early 1970s, where there really is a fairly substantial amount of intersection, usually involving, almost always involving, questions about race, and the relationship between that and the civil rights movement is pretty apparent. Should we talk about some of those? Do you want to talk about Jackie Robinson?
Sure. I mean, the most obvious and arguably the most important one is Jackie Robinson breaking the so-called color line in baseball. Now, there had been there have been at least one African American player in baseball in the late 19th century.
I think Moses Fleetwood Walker.
Yes, but
there may have been. There looks like there may have been a second.
Right,
but anyway.
But the point is, for most of the history of baseball, and certainly for the 20th century, there had been a kind of prohibition on African Americans playing Major League Baseball.
Yes,
and as a consequence, a kind of parallel. Because baseball was incredibly popular in the United States in the early 20th century. I mean, it was the dominant sport and cultural activity in many respects. And so there was a parallel. There were the Negro Leagues that African Americans played in. And in the off-season, black teams and white teams would play each other, often professional teams. But no African American played in the major leagues during the 20th century until the Brooklyn Dodgers brought Jackie Robinson in 1947. And Robinson was a multi-sport athlete at UCLA, I think, and an athletic star. He was a veteran of the Army. And this was a very important moment in the history of the United States. I think it's very... I think Jackie Robinson is there with people like Rosa Parks as an important civil rights activist and pioneer. I think there's no question about that. And they brought him up through the minor leagues initially in Montreal. He played for a minor league team in Montreal.
It's important that they send him to Canada to play for
Indeed, because they were trying to ease him in and they thought it'll be easier in Canada. The Dodgers spent their spring training in 1947 in Cuba deliberately because of this. And there was a lot of opposition within the team to this because many of the players in Major League Baseball were white Southerners.
And one thing I think is worth pointing out, thinking about the relationship between race and sports, is the sports that were segregated were team sports, right? That you had African Americans participating at the national and international level in
boxing
and track and field and all the sort of individual sports. It tended to be about competition against a black player. It's tending to be playing alongside a black player that seems to be the big point of tension.
That's right. And there's a moment during spring training for the Dodgers in the spring of 1947 when there's a confrontation in the team hotel.
Pee Wee Reese, I think, stood up for him.
That's right. But some of the players didn't. Famously Dixie Walker, whose nickname suggests his origins. And so there was opposition within the team. Robinson makes his debut in the spring of 1947. It helps that he's a fantastic player, but he meets incredible amounts of racism, really for years afterwards, and death threats, and there are problems with traveling, and it's some places in particular are especially virulent and in their opposition and criticism of Robinson. St. Louis, Philadelphia, Boston in particular, and Robinson. But the Robinson's importance is very, very difficult to overstate. Robinson breaks the color barrier a year before President Truman integrates the armed forces. But I think there's a post-war attempt to reconcile the principles for which the United States is supposed to stand and essentially apartheid, which existed in the country at that point. And Robinson's an incredibly important figure in helping to break that down in the broader culture. And yeah, Robinson's a really, really quite important figure. And then we jump ahead a generation, and there's a lot of activism and in the 1960s and 70s. But to some extent, the modern kind of intersection of politics and sports and race and racial protest in sports begins with Robinson. Although, before I hand things over to you, David, I'd qualify it slightly and say what Robinson was doing was integrating his sport, and that had implications for the broader culture. Sure. What we've seen more recently with these protests by Colin Kaepernick and the like is athletes using their prominence to comment on what they see as injustice in society. Whereas Robinson was taking on injustice within his sport, which obviously had broader implications for society. It's a slight distinction, I'm in no way criticizing. In fact, I'm fully sympathetic with and supportive of the current protest. Yeah. But I think the perspective is slightly different. Yeah.
Now when we think about the '60s, they are the examples that come to mind tend to be ones where athletes are using their prominence to talk about broader national and international issues. So we think about Muhammad Ali's refusal to be inducted into the draft on religious and moral grounds, refusing to participate in the Vietnam War because of his, opposition to racism within the United States and all these other kinds of things. That is very much him using his status as the heavyweight champion of the world gets drafted in 66, and then not fighting for
5 years.
5 years, which would have been the sort of prime of his career as a consequence of that. That's a fairly well-known episode. And he has, obviously the earlier episode where he changes his name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali. That was also a, political statement that he was able to make, because I think he changed his name right after he became heavyweight champion.
Yes.
And
even prior to that, he'd won a gold medal at the Rome Olympics in 1960.
Yeah.
And then was, I think, quite energized and politicized by the amount of racism he encountered when he returned. He was from Louisville, Kentucky. When he returned home.
The other sort of obvious political, the image that comes to mind with sports and politics in the '60s is the '68 Olympics. Do you want to talk a little bit about the events? I mean, I think everyone has the image of the photo.
The very famous image of John Carlos and Tommy Smith, two African-American athletes at the Mexico City Olympics, giving the Black Power salute. Yeah. They had, I'm making the salute, but only David can see it.
It's a podcast, Frank. They can't see it.
And they had black gloves on as well. And they and interestingly, the third guy in the picture, and there's an interesting documentary about this.
The guy who won silver.
Yeah, is Australian, and he supported them.
Yeah.
They had told him, he knew about it in advance. And so they make the Black Power salute at the 1968 Olympics. Mm-hmm. One is the gold medalist, the other was the bronze medalist. They were the U.S. Olympic Committee took away their medals.
Yeah,
it is a seminal.
Well, the International Olympic Committee, I think.
Right, sorry, and the U.S. Olympic Committee suspended them. Because they weren't supposed to make a political statement. Yeah. Now, as you intimated earlier, the Olympics have always been about politics. That's the 1936 Berlin Olympics were meant to be the Nazi Olympics. You can't separate politics from the Olympics, but this was seen as going too far.
Well, they're playing the national anthem of the winning, you know, whoever wins the gold medal, when they give them the gold medal, it's super patriotic.
Sure. But in that sense, I think it is akin to what's going on currently, because they were taking that moment when the national anthem was being played to make a statement. Yeah. They were doing so in the context of 1968.
Sure. So this is after Martin Luther King's assassination.
Right. And the huge riots of 67 and 68. And
Vietnam and everything.
Right. So massive amounts of police violence against black people in the United States. It's a very, very restive period, obviously, and they're making the statement, and this image is quite famous. I'd say two things. The examples we're using from the 60s of Muhammad Ali and John Carlos and Tommy Smith were, as you said before, instances of protest in an international context. Mm. So this is in the context of the Cold War. These people are embarrassing the United States, which is... that's what their critics say. And I think that they're used... And the second thing I would say is that they're... I guess they're using the platform provided to them by their success and their prominence. So they anticipate what's going to come later.
Yeah.
So I think we can see them as transitional moments. The other thing I would say is, at the time, all of these people were opposed. And people said, it's too much, it's too far.
Well, of course, there were meaningful consequences.
There were meaningful consequences, but I think what's interesting is, because we're hearing this right now about the NFL protests and the other sports protests. No, don't do it now. There's a time and a place.
Yeah.
Yet, we celebrate these people in retrospect.
Right.
So the majority of people thought that Jackie Robinson was kind of causing trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Or that John Carlos and Tommy Smith shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
And Muhammad Ali, you know, when Muhammad Ali died a year or so ago, you know, he was celebrated as
most
one of the greatest. He was not beloved during his lifetime, but, you know, he was a very divisive figure.
Yeah.
And so I think these moments of protest usually upset people, at least the majority of people, and they're usually condemned.
Yeah. Well, and
then in retrospect, we celebrate them.
And a third figure from the 60s that I think sort of fits into that model really well, and it's not a person who's necessarily as well known as these other examples, but Curt Flood.
Do you want to say a bit about Curt Flood?
So Curt Flood was a center fielder for I think the Cardinals.
The Cardinals, yes. And a very good one.
You know, he led the league in hits several times, and he batted 300, led the league in, he was a really skilled outfielder. His team tried to trade him to the Phillies, and he had been playing for the Cardinals for many years, and he basically said no, that I'm a adult man, I should get to pick who I want to work for, but one of the premises of baseball is something called the reserve clause that has its origins back, I think actually in the 19th century, which basically says that whatever team signs you has the right to do with you pretty much whatever they want. You don't have the right to go and offer your services to a different club. And Curt Flood didn't want to go play for the Phillies for a number of reasons. He had a life in St. Louis. He didn't like the racial dynamics in Philadelphia. He thought the fans there were pretty racist and didn't want to go play for them. And he goes and he basically says, I'm not going to play for them, and he sues to try to overturn the reserve clause, and he describes it essentially as a kind of slavery, that the bonding players to teams and not allowing them to become what are now known as free agents, that was a kind of legal... he thought, and the legal restraint of trade and all these other kinds of things. And it's worth, I think, pointing out that, there are lots of players that have been hurt by the reserve clause that probably could have offered their labors to other teams. But it was an African-American player who did it, it's worth pointing out. He goes in court, he loses, Curt Flood loses in court, goes all the way up to the Supreme Court and he loses, but it becomes sort of the framework for later free agency in the 1970s, which really transforms how baseball worked and how players moved around from different teams.
And sport more generally, because it allows for free agency.
In other sports. And it actually, one of the things that allows athletes now to make as much money as they do is free agency. You know, beforehand, the only team you could negotiate with was the one that signed you originally, which, you know, isn't really much of a bargaining position. You know, it's free agency that's led to million-dollar contracts. So Curt Flood is directly responsible for that happening. And he suffered the consequences of it because he lost in court. And rather than playing for the Phillies, he sat out for, I think, at least one season, maybe two seasons. And then the Phillies trade him because they supposedly owned him at that point, I think, to the Senators. And he played one or two more seasons after that, but he wasn't nearly as good then as he had been before this all happened. But I think he's somebody whose status as, a hero has also, you know, at the time he was vilified. He got death threats. All
people said he was going to ruin baseball.
Baseball, yeah. And now I think he's seen as a hero and somebody who was willing to sort of sacrifice his personal career for the advantage of broader issues.
I'm glad you mentioned Flood because he really is a kind of crucial figure, and he's less well known than the others we've discussed. Again, I think we could make a distinction between Jackie Robinson and Curt Flood, who essentially were seeking to reform their sports, took stands to do so, and in so doing, transformed the broader culture. Yeah. And say, John Carlos and Tommy Smith and Muhammad Ali, who were using their prominence to make a broader statement about society. Yeah. And so I think, I'm not kind of privileging one over the other. I just think there are two paths here. And I think what we've seen in the past week and what we will see for the foreseeable future is athletes doing the latter, which is they're using their prominence to make this broader statement, I think.
One thing I think is worth pointing out is there are lots of athletes, we're talking about athletes who do take political stands. These tend to be the exception rather than the rule. Most athletes don't, even when they have the opportunity to. There's the example that comes to mind. There was a Senate race in North Carolina where Jesse Helms, who has all the kind of racial politics people associate with Jesse Helms, was being challenged by Harvey Gantt, an African-American former mayor of Charlotte. And the Gantt campaign approached Michael Jordan, who at that point was still is probably the greatest basketball player to ever live and a hugely prominent global figure.
And incredibly important in North Carolina.
Because he had played at UNC Chapel Hill and got with them to a national championship. And all, so he's huge megastar beyond compare. And Jordan's response was, Republicans buy basketball shoes too. And so he said, I'm not going to, get involved in politics. I'm going to play basketball and I'm going to sell shoes. It's not my place to, use my status to interfere in politics.
That's true. Although, interestingly, Michael Jordan got involved on social media last week condemning President Trump's comments. And I wonder if we haven't seen a change because of social media. I think in basketball in particular, I think if we were going to plot these leagues on the political spectrum, I think basketball is the furthest to the left, both in terms of its players' political beliefs and awareness, at least as demonstrated, expressed in social media, and the fan base.
Yes.
And so even Michael Jordan got involved, and I wonder if some athletes aren't becoming more comfortable expressing their politics. LeBron James, who's the current greatest basketball player in the world, is quite upfront and was an early supporter of Black Lives Matter. And what was interesting, if you contrast him to Colin Kaepernick, who has been drummed out of the NFL as a consequence of his political statement, there's been no backlash like that in the NBA, I think. And I think that's interesting. But I think more broadly we're seeing some players are more willing to express their politics and express protest. I think you're right, though. I think we shouldn't overstate how widespread this is. So I think the NFL protests last weekend were interesting. It's unclear to me Whether, you know, so on Monday night, I think it was, the entire Dallas Cowboys team came out and kneeled before the national anthem and then stood for the national anthem. Now, I don't know whether that, I don't know how you read that. Some of this is teams have to stick together. That's the ethos of teams and a team sport. But I don't know whether everyone necessarily agrees with Colin Kaepernick's protest when they did that, or so much as they were reacting against President Trump's attack on NFL players. Yeah. It should be said, the one thing people focused on is he called the players who do this sons of bitches.
Yeah.
And that really resonated. People said, you know, you shouldn't call our teammates sons of bitches.
Yeah.
And so I think players, particularly white players, and I think white NFL players are probably more conservative than African-American NFL players as a rule. Sided with their teammates who'd been attacked, as opposed to, or some of those who went out and kneeled last weekend were siding with their teammates rather than making a statement about Black Lives Matter.
I mean, I think the interplay here between the politics of the players and the politics of the fan base is interesting, because I mean, as you point out, basketball, predominantly liberal, if we're going to sort of do these sort of simple liners, predominantly liberal players, predominantly liberal fan base. Football, predominantly maybe liberal players, or at least elements of liberal players, but a very conservative fan base for football.
Yep.
You know, anything about NASCAR, that's a conservative drivers and owners and pit crew and conservative fan base.
Although, I remember last autumn, the New York Times did a profile of the NFL. They'd kind of really done, looked at the data. And the claim, because I would agree with you, if you asked me, I would agree with the statement you just made. But if my memory serves, and I could be wrong, they found that the NFL fan base was the one that looked most like America in terms of the way it was divided politically and socially.
Really?
In part because it's the biggest fan base, because it's the most popular sport. Okay. Whereas the NBA trends to the left, NASCAR to the right. I still find that problematic, and I think the fans in the stands at the NFL, the ones who are actually buying tickets and going to games, are probably more conservative. I think, you know, it's expensive. Yeah. It's a slightly older white male demographic, which is the Trump voter, or an element of the Trump coalition. So, but I think maybe the people watching at home more broadly reflect the United States. I don't know.
Well, we've been talking mostly here about players getting involved in politics. I mean, one of the interesting things about Trump's speech last week is it's politicians getting involved in sports, which is even rarer. So, I mean, what other sort of examples do we have of political figures trying to interfere, if that's what this is, trying to interfere or change sports?
Well, there's the Olympics. Yeah, because normally what happens is, you know, you just appear with a winning team, you get your picture taken, it's good for them, good for you, you throw out the first pitch. I think, you know, what I alluded to earlier, I think President Bush's appearance at the World Series back in 2001 was a political statement in the sense that he was the leader of the country, but it was a pretty important moment. But
there's the Olympics. Sometimes the political forces get involved for obvious reasons because it's international, you know, sports. So you can think about the United States not participating in the 1980 Olympics, if I remember.
That's right, over the invasion of
Afghanistan. You know, and so there's that. The only other, you know, example I can think of a president actively getting involved in sports actually has some interesting resonances with what Trump said. Because one of the things that about Trump's speech about the NFL, before he talks about the kneeling and the national anthem, the first thing he said was he thought that football was becoming not violent enough.
Yeah, so the referees are ruining it. It's not as good as it used to be.
You know, there's concerns about traumatic brain injury.
He's just a ranting old man.
Yeah, so he wants football to be back like it was in the good old days when people, you know, got concussions and all other kind of, well, people still get concussions, but he wants to, you know, be more violent. The closest parallel, actually, you know, to that part of his speech happened more than 100 years ago with Teddy Roosevelt, where Teddy Roosevelt gets involved in football because football was getting too violent, especially college football. I guess there only was college football at that point.
And college football was huge then.
And
remains so now.
But, you know, college football, there were dozens of players dying every year I mean, not just like traumatic brain injury, you know, long-term effects. These are people dying on the field and a huge number of them getting injured. And including one of the people who got injured, by the way, was Teddy Roosevelt's son, who was playing, I think, for Harvard at the time. And so he calls the leading football coaches in the country, you know, to a meeting when I think the leading football coaches in the time were Harvard and Yale, because that's back when Harvard and Yale had good football teams. Apologies to Harvard and Yale football fans. And he says, basically, you know, the political position we're in right now is either you guys change football or we're going to have to ban football. Which would you guys rather have? And Teddy Roosevelt, of course, was somebody who had played football. You know, he liked to box. You know, he's somebody who has no aversion to, and he likes to kill people. So he has no aversion to violence.
He's a man's man.
He's the man in the arena, right? Yeah. He recognized the sort of the political, you know, weight of the thing was football needed to change. Otherwise, you know, football would probably have to be stopped as a sport because so many people were dying. And as a sort of consequence of this, American football fundamentally changes. They introduce a number of rule changes to make it less violent, or at least less deadly. Including this is when they start to have the neutral zone between the players, the line of scrimmage, and when they introduce the forward pass. So the modern football, in some ways, is derived from a president intervening and saying we need to actually change the sport.
And that is, just in terms of the history of the sport, a crucial evolutionary moment when rugby and football diverge. The forward pass, that's the crucial difference.
Yeah. So, you know, we have the president to thank for modern football, but, you know, that in some ways there's the mirror image, really, of what Trump was saying, that we need to...
Well, although it's the reverse. Trump wants it to be more violent.
Yeah, whereas, that's what I mean. Yeah, yeah.
TR was saying, maybe a little less violent.
Violent, yes.
Interesting. So I feel like we've degenerated into sports radio here. So it's Dave and Frank in the morning zoo here on Sports Radio Edinburgh.
No. Oh, God, that was awful.
What's your last drop, Dave?
All right, so I was pretty excited earlier this week, in a nerdy kind of way that academics get excited, by the discovery of a new essay by George Moses Horton. Horton was a slave in North Carolina in the 20s and 30s, who lived not far from the campus of UNC Chapel Hill. And the sort of mythology about him is that he would, during the week, be a slave and plow a field, and on the weekend he would travel to campus and sell poetry to students. And he was famous for acrostics and other kinds of novelty poetry at the time. But a essay of his was discovered in the New York Public Library by a scholar who was working there. So we have new texts from this very famous early African American writer. And I'm sometimes skeptical when I see, you know, people saying, "Oh, we discovered this new thing in the archive."
In a library.
Because usually it's in the finding aid, and it just means that historians weren't fully aware of whatever it is, but that archivists had already, you know, cataloged it or something. In this case, it seems to have been a not fully processed collection, and nobody actually knew this document was there. So it really is an interesting find of a new source for understanding, you know, slavery from a slave's perspective.
Is he a good poet?
He's a very good poet, yeah. I mean, given, you know, his complete lack of education, you know, and, you know, the fact that he's writing his poetry when he's behind a plow, you know, and memorizing it, basically, and then, you know, delivering it to students. He published a book while he's a slave in, I think, 1829. He tries at various points in time to acquire his freedom as a consequence of that, and so it's a... He's an interesting figure. They actually recently named a dormitory after him at UNC Chapel Hill.
Oh, interesting.
So I'm very excited about always getting new sources, because you kind of think, well, the past has already delivered all of its things to us, and every so often you find that there's new things to read.
Excellent.
What do you got?
I have been listening rather obsessively to a soundtrack, and it's the soundtrack to the there's a show in London right now in the West End based on the music and life of Bob Dylan, or called Girl from the North Country.
Okay.
And I can just heartily recommend the Girl from the North Country soundtrack. It is fabulous. Basically, it, well, imagine the songs of Bob Dylan sung by people who can sing.
Oh.
I mean, I'm a big Bob Dylan fan. I know you are too, David. But this will rock your world, my friend. You've got to listen to this. It's fabulous.
And how is this going to work with the debate with your wife over whether he deserves the Nobel Prize or not?
I'm not going to revisit that. She's already mad at me for being mean to you last week, David. I can't go back to this one. But
okay.
I can hardly... It's not historical, I suppose, except insofar as he's a major cultural figure of the 20th century. Yeah. So, but I highly recommend it. Girl from the North Country soundtrack.
If anyone in London wants to get Frank tickets, you know, I don't think you would object.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Actually, my meat tickets, too. We both want to. Well, we will go. We will see the show.
I think it's only on for another couple of weeks.
Oh, jeez.
But I have a feeling it'll be back, and we'll go to New York eventually. But anyway, cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.